Accession number 30276, Reel 1.
This is the first reel of a taped interview with Bill Dowell in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 4th of the 10th, 2007, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Bill, can we begin the interview by you telling us your full name and where and when you were born, please?
My full name is William Leslie Dowell, and I was born in Melbourne in the 9th of October 1923. My father was a boot manufacturer, or he worked for a boot manufacturer. He was a tradesman. I was the fourth child of an eventual family of seven. At that time, my first recollections of Melbourne in those days, I was living in Collingwood. That was where the boot trade was, and my father was employed in Collingwood in a boot factory. And although he wasn't a serviceman in the First World War, most of his friends were. He had married my mother during the war, and he didn't volunteer. And apart from that, I don't think he wanted to. But I remember that most of his friends were ex-servicemen. And I heard some of their stories. They didn't talk about it much, but I knew about the First World War. In fact, in those days, we used to play Germans and goodies, you know. And it was the thing was with little boys running around shooting the Germans dead. And anyway, I grew up and started school in Collingwood. Right next to the Collingwood football ground. It was a state school, Victoria Park. And I went to school there for a few years and then later on transferred to another school where I finished my education. When it was time for me to finish my education, which was elementary, I decided to get a job, and at that time it was very difficult. It was Depression years, and we were still in Depression. And the most work I could get was pretty uninteresting, labouring and unskilled work. And but at that time, I remember, we were building up to what I thought was a war. We heard about Germany and Hitler, Mussolini, and It was in the air at that time for about 3 or 4 years prior to the outbreak of war. I was thinking war was eventually declared, and I remember listening to the radio at home and heard the Prime Minister, Robert Menzies at the time, say we're at war with Germany. And I thought that I would never see any of it because I was 15. But suddenly the Depression was over. There was plenty of work about, and it was easy to get a job. And for the first time for years, my father and even my mother went to work. And it was unheard of before the war that married women worked. Once they were married, they had to give up work. And suddenly there was plenty of work about, and but then as the war got on and the Battle of Britain, and my older brother, who was 3 years older than me, joined the army, suddenly the thought of being in the army and the adventure appealed to me. And I thought, well, I was in a boring job. It wasn't a well-paid job, and the army offered 5 shillings a day and all found. So I thought, well, that sounded pretty good. And but my parents wouldn't allow me to put my age up and join the AIF. But what I did do was register for national service. At that time, the Australian government had decided that every young man over the certain age would have to do 6 months military training And so I thought, well, I'll do 6 months. I'll be in the army for 6 months, and should be interesting and a bit of an adventure. At that time, I'd never been out of Melbourne. I didn't own a motor car. I didn't own a push bike. Never thought about it. I had nothing. We were poor people. And in fact, if we look back, and I look back now and say, well, if the people that are supposed to be on the poverty line today lived like we did, they would know what poverty was. And we were very poor. But we didn't know we were poor because everybody else was at that time, in the working class people of Melbourne, and particularly in the boot trade. Anyway, I registered by putting my age up. I was 17 at the time. And, of course, when I got the call up to go into the army, my parents didn't know I put my age up, so they thought I'd just got the natural call-up. And so into the army I went. It was on the 5th of November 1941. And I went into an infantry battalion, the Royal Melbourne Regiment, or 6th Battalion. And the initial training was hard, but I rather liked it. I met a lot of mates, and I saw things and experienced things I had never experienced before. And even driving in on the back of a truck was a bit of an adventure to me in those days. And we started our initial training, and I think it was about... I'd only been in the army about 4 weeks, and one Sunday morning we had a route march, and we came back and we heard the news that the Japs had bombed Pearl Harbor, and we couldn't believe it. It was just sort of amazing news. It was we never thought anything like that could possibly happen, but they were told, forget 6 months, we're into the end of the war. So later on we did our training, and I started off as the Vickers machine gunner, and then they decided to do away with the machine gun company in the battalion, and I became a SIG. And that's how I finished the rest of my time in the army, as an infantry signalman. And it was good because I got 2 shillings a day extra.
Let's go back a little way. Obviously, you'd spoken about a whole range of different things there, and you've spoken earlier on about your father not going to World War One.
Yeah.
Had there been a reason for him not to go? Had he been a conscientious objector, or...?
No, I think he was just smarter than the others. I think the others were joining up, leaving their wives and families, and for instance, my father-in-law, he had 4 children, and he joined up and went to France. He wasn't in Gallipoli, but he went to France. Well, I think that was... In my personal opinion, I think it was pretty outrageous that a man with 4 young children would join up and go off with his mates to war. He wasn't, I don't know whether he was that patriotic, but I think he just wanted the adventure, and he wanted to get away from a boring marriage, or a marriage that had become a bit humdrum with 4 little kids running around. And he thought he's off on a big adventure, going to France and seeing Europe. And, well, I thought the same thing. But my father was, I think, maybe was a bit of a coward, and he decided he wasn't going to volunteer.
Had it caused him any problems in his life?
No.
Post-war?
No.
Post-World War I?
He had many, I would say almost all of his friends were ex-servicemen. But I can't recall or ever heard that they looked down on him because he didn't volunteer and go away. And that's the same with me. I mean, I make friends with lots of men that didn't, for some reason or other, volunteer during World War II, and that doesn't faze me. And I don't think it does worry most servicemen. I just say, well, that was their choice, or maybe their situation, maybe their health, or whatever. But at the same time, I think there's a camaraderie between ex-servicemen.
We can talk about that too. Mm. And obviously, you were mentioning as you grew up that you would be playing Germans and good guys.
Yeah.
Did you understand the older you became, the realities of the First World War? I mean, you'd heard some stories.
There were films. I can remember watching a film which I was very impressed with. It, in fact, I think it was one of the greatest films ever made, was a film called All Quiet on the Western Front. And it was written by a German, and it was about Germans. And that, I thought, was reality. All the other stuff that you read about or told about, and I thought, no, that picture, that story, was factual. It was about young boys that were induced by their school teacher to join the army and what they suffered on the Western Front. And I thought, at that time, I would have been about 13 or 14, I thought, well, I'll never, ever join the army. but then again, when the Battle of Britain was on and France fell and your friends were joining up and suddenly two of my best friends were were a year older than me, and they were being called up for this national service for 6 months. And I thought, well, I'll go along and do the same thing, put my age up and go in with them. And the three of us joined on the same day. And we went to the same battalion. One of them was killed later on, but two of us survived all right. And attitudes changed over those couple of years from the beginning of the war until I joined the army. And it was caused by propaganda. It was caused by a sense of patriotism, and it was also probably a sense of adventure. Mm. You can imagine me, I was 17 and I'd never been out of Melbourne, and the thought of travelling overseas to other countries was just not feasible in those days, because the little money that I earned and I paid my mother board and we just didn't have the money. I think I was getting about 30 shillings a week in those days. It was $6 a week. And suddenly the army pay looked very attractive. And also the adventure at the time. And also I thought, well, I'm only going in for national service. But once the Japanese came into the war, and we were at war with Japan, and they start to come down the Malaysian Peninsula and into New Guinea, we were asked to join the permanent army. And I would say out of the battalion I was in, I think about 85% said yes, they would, and they signed papers. And at that time, because of the restrictions conscription, they couldn't be sent overseas. We couldn't be sent overseas. But once we volunteered and signed to join the AOF, we could be sent overseas. And I spent about 12 months in that battalion in Darwin and Western Australia. And then there were a lot of casualties in the Australian AOF who were in New Guinea. The training battalions were broken up, and we went as reinforcements to other battalions.
Okay. In relation to the coming of World War II, and you mentioned obviously playing Germans and good guys and seeing All Quiet on the Western Front, when you possibly from afar, or well, definitely from afar, heard what was going on and how the Germans were conducting their war, what was your opinion towards the foe that you were facing at that time?
Oh, the opinion was that you wanted to defeat them and see them defeated. We start to understand something about fascism and Nazism. Communism was pretty strong in Australia at that time. Even in the army, there was quite a lot of communist support. I can remember going to the theatre and on the screen before the show started would come the King of England and Roosevelt, and there was the cries, well, what about Joe? What about Joe Stalin? You know, because he didn't come up on the screen. And Kai-shek, I think it was Chiang Kai what was his name, the Chinese leader? I think he came up on the screen, but Joe Stalin didn't.
Chiang Kai-shek.
That's it, yes.
In relation to the Germans, though, and people talk of, and you mentioned Dunkirk, the fall of, certainly the Battle of Britain, the impression that you got of the ability of this
German machine. Well, they were, we thought that they were well organised and that they could take over the world. But if, at that time, we were subject to a lot of propaganda. You know what they say, that the first casualty of war is the truth. And we weren't hearing all the truth. We were hearing what our government and the British government wanted us to hear. So we didn't really... I can remember looking at newspapers and seeing where the lines were and how they were advancing. But we always got a... They told us how many planes they shot, how many German planes they shot down over the Battle of Britain, but they didn't give us an accurate picture of the losses. And so we were sort of... I think everybody was brainwashed to a certain extent as to the gravity of it and the... But we knew about the brutality of the Germans. I mean, bombing Amsterdam and Warsaw and all those places, and we realised that they were a pretty brutal regime at that time under Hitler. And I think everybody, 99% of the population of Australia, were very anti-German. In fact, I think there was among Germans that had migrated to Australia before the Second World War, we're all interned, so were the Italians, and there was a lot of ill feeling. Italian businesses and German businesses got a hard time, and most people who had Italian or German blood, they sort of try to hide the fact. And we knew a bit about the persecution of the Jews, because many... just before the war, many Jews migrated to Australia, and they were referred to as refugees. And of course, they was telling their story of how they were persecuted and fled from the country. But we didn't know about the death camps. We didn't know about the mass executions. We didn't know about the terrible way that some prisoners of war, slave labour, and all that sort of thing. That all came out after the war. And there was a lot of sympathy for the Russians. In fact, there were a lot of communists. Even in the battalion I was in, there was meetings, and I remember books being passed around, and one of the main books passed around and read by everybody and was influenced by it was Dr. Hewlett Johnson, the Dean of Canterbury. He wrote a book called The Socialist Six of the World. And he predicted that in that book that... Germany would be defeated. Once they invaded Russia, that would be their mistake that would cause their defeat. And well, he was pretty right as well as that. And even after the war, there was a lot of communist sympathy, but that sort of dissipated in a way, you know, until we start to learn that the Stalin regime was just probably as bad as the Germans. And so things change. I mean, it becomes the fashion to be this or that, and history shows that we change our opinions and all the time, philosophy.
In relation to the Germans, and obviously we hear of this sort of almost phony war period.
Yes.
After the initial declaration.
Yeah.
Not much happens.
No.
Certainly not... Not that it would affect Australia necessarily, a young bloke like yourself. What was it like then when Dunkirk happened? What was it like then when it seemed as though Germany had basically won Europe?
Yes, as you mentioned, the phony war, when nothing happened. And we heard news that Britain had flown over Europe dropping pamphlets, not bombs, pamphlets. And it was sort of a phony war, but there was a lot of reason behind it, and which we didn't know at that time, the reasons, and Britain was rearming and Germany was building up and getting ready for the invasion of France. When France was invaded and Dunkirk, and then the Battle of Britain and pretty much the destruction of London, and Coventry was bombed, and all these countries, really, that was when the time was that I think everybody that thought about it, that it was a possibility that we could lose the war and probably be dominated by Germany. And then when Japan came into the war, we imagined that it would be Japan that would invade Australia and dominate Australia. And that was horrendous because we heard worse things about the Japanese than the Germans. Now, in the light of what I know and what history teaches us, I think that probably the Nazis were the worse than the Japanese. But anyway, everybody became, at that time, there was no voices of dissent about whatever we did.
Mm. And you mentioned, obviously, joining the National Service. How was the National Service seen, given that you could volunteer, presumably?
There was a little bit about... the National Service was seen by the volunteers that joined the RAF were called chocolate soldiers, because they didn't volunteer to go overseas. And there was a bit of animosity. The volunteers, as they were coming back from the Middle East, thought that the National Service were chocolate soldiers. But that dissipated after a while, because I'd say 80% of the conscripts that were in those days became volunteers and joined AIF, or volunteer battalions, which I did. And once I moved into that, obviously, except that I was never, I don't think anybody ever mentioned to me, were you a choco or at the first place or anything like that. No, there wasn't. I don't think servicemen during the war were looking down on anybody that hadn't made the sacrifices they made or volunteered to do the things that they did. That was their choice, and that was your choice. Mm. And there was a little bit, but not much. Mm. Not that affected me in any way.
Let's talk then about the coming of the Japanese. And you mentioned, obviously, a little bit of information that you had in relation to how they were seen pre their bombing of Pearl Harbor. How was the Japanese force seen compared to such as the German or Italian?
Well, we were told before the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor that one white man was equal to about 60 Japanese, and they were no threat. They were no threat. A battalion could probably take out a couple of divisions. You know, we were all Rambos, and they were hopeless. Well, it turned out that they were far more better trained and equipped than we were, and at that time, and that's how we saw the Japanese. In fact, all the cartoons in the paper had little men with short sight, thick rimmed glasses on, and buck teeth. And this sort of thing, you know. A zero aeroplane was another word for nothing. That was encouraged us to believe that. But suddenly, here's this inferior race of people have practically wiped out the American fleet at Pearl Harbor, the Pacific Fleet. They moved rapidly down into Malaysia and took Singapore, which was...
What was it like when Singapore fell?
Oh, it was scary, because the population started to think, you know, what's going to happen? Who are we? And it made everybody work harder. More people volunteered and for different things. And it was suddenly all stops out to rearm and train and whatever. And they set up jungle schools for the army, and we did jungle training courses. Up to that time, it had been all desert training. and that was one of the reasons why they did away with the machine gun battalion. We had five companies in a battalion: A, B, C, and D, headquarters, and E Company. And they did away with E Company because the Vickers machine gun was pretty useless in the jungle. And we all went to sent off to jungle training schools. By that time, the Japanese had moved right down through Indonesia, kicked the Dutch out of the Dutch East Indies at the time, and were in New Guinea. And so there was a big panic.
What have you heard of the bombing of places like Pearl Harbor? Of Darwin and Broome?
We knew Darwin had been bombed. I was in the army at the time, and we were sent there because they thought the bombing was pre-invasion. It may have been. It could have been that. And by the time we got up there, the devastation of Darwin, it was horrendous, you know. There was
practically... Describe it. I mean, aren't we sort of hear a few bombs dropped here, there and the other? And...
Well, when we arrived there, we arrived after the first couple of bombing raids, which are the big ones. And it was the same Japanese aircraft carriers that were involved in Pearl Harbor, and they were pretty expert flyers, and they just came in there and they bombed every ship that was in the harbor. They knocked out all the installations that they thought were important. When we arrived there, there was hardly a building left standing, and. And the harbour was full of sunken ships. At low tide, you could see the masts sticking up out of the water, so it was a pretty devastating bombing. But then remember that Darwin at that time wasn't anything like the size it is today. It was probably a town of about 15, 20,000 people. All the civilians immediately fled or were evacuated. And when we got there, there were no civilians at all. And there were a few Aboriginals, but only males. And they helped the army by doing tasks like emptying the sanitary pans and that sort of thing, cleaning up and one thing and another. And they were real tribesmen in those days. They all had their tribal scars on their forehead and their cheeks and arms and chest. And they didn't speak English, most of them. And they just ran around and in their tribal. They were real savages, really, at that time. But so we stayed there. Darwin built fortifications and trained and one thing another. And then the invasion fleet. Now I don't know to this day where they were headed. In the Battle of the Coral Sea, but there was a big invasion fleet. And and of course they were met by the Australian and American Navy, and they were pretty badly mauled. At that time, suddenly they were realising the Japanese were not stupid, and they were not ill trained, and they were not badly equipped. So they had to try and catch up. And I think it was at the Battle of Coral Sea that they started to get on top of the. And from then on, after the Battle of Coral Sea, I think the relief was that they wouldn't be able to invade Australia. And then we were taken out of Darwin, sent to these other battalions, and finished up in New Guinea, most of us.
What have you heard, for instance, of